Good evening and welcome to Tuesday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight we have Regina Doherty, Fine Gael Senator and Leader of the Senedd; Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD and Spokesperson on Enterprise, Trade and Employment; Hazel Chu, Dublin Lord Mayor and Green Party Chairperson; and Hugh O'Connell, Political Correspondent for Independent Newspapers. Later we'll be revisiting a saga that still sends shivers down some politicians' spines, the ill-fated attempt to introduce electronic voting in the early noughties, and that's tonight's Late Diversion with David Davenport. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Now, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly has said he believes people could be vaccinated here between 7 and 10 days after the European Medicines Agency authorises the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine and the European Commission gives its permission. If this happens as expected next week, we could see people getting vaccinated here in the last days of December or the first days of January. Regina, are we ready for this?
Jesus, I think that definitely the Irish people are ready for it. When you listen to older people ringing Liveline this evening or texting in saying they're ringing their doctors tomorrow to make appointments, I think the country is definitely ready for it.
No, I know we're ready for it, yeah. But are we ready to, are we so tooled up for it?
I heard the questions that were asked this evening. I think the high-level task force that was established at Brian McRae a couple of weeks ago has very understatedly being preparing for the last number of weeks. I think the plan that was released today, approved by Cabinet this morning, is very comprehensive. Yeah, there's going to be questions. There's going to be things that will arise. And actually, I think, now I might be shot for saying this, but I think the opposition's request today of having a rolling schedule in the Dáil and the Senedd on a weekly basis so that if there are concerns, they can be aired, given that we don't have the COVID committee anymore. I think that's a good idea. I think we should, all of us, want to be on the same page. If people have, you know, questions or concerns, I think they should be raised. And I think we all should be shown leadership from every party and from all independents to say that, yes, there may be concerns, but those concerns need to be allayed. And they may be IT concerns, they may be vaccine concerns.
But just go back, that IT concern, that's the one that Roisin Shortall was talking about today, that we've, I think, chosen the company that will do it, but we haven't issued the tender, we haven't, you know, gone that far with it yet. I mean, people will be surprised that, because obviously we've known that this vaccine was in development for many months. We have, you know, it's, you would have thought that we've known we'd need an IT system and that this was one of the issues that was definitely having to be done. So why are we still at this stage of it?
Well, I don't think we're still at this stage. I think we're preparing for going live in the next couple of weeks, and that's what the Minister said this afternoon. But I do also think that they needed to look at the IT system that we currently use for the rollout of 1.2 million vaccines every year. Now, I know we're going to be looking at 4.8 million times two, and it's slightly obviously larger, but an IT system is an IT system. It needs to be robust, it needs to be able to be managed.
We don't have a great record of this in the health service, do we? IT system working well for us.
To be fair, right, I know, and you can draw examples of the identifiers that were to be and then still weren't and stuff. There's always something as more important has gotten in the way. There's nothing more important than this. Nothing. I mean, we can see the hundreds of thousands of people who are out of work. We see the millions of people whose lives are in limbo. We see the 3,000 plus people and families who've lost loved ones this year. There's nothing more important than this. So whatever crops up needs to be resolved, whatever issues need to be cleared the way to make sure that we get it right for D-Day when we go live, that'll be done and Brian McRae will make sure it's done.
Well, I think the task force under Brian McRae have done really good work. I think they've given a roadmap. What we need to see now is that roadmap resourced. And we need to know that the equipment is going to be there. So it's, you know, if we are going to be having these pop-up vaccination centres, well, then the location of those needs to be identified. And we also need to have the staff. So we can't have another repeat of the On Call for Ireland debacle. That's not going to work. This has to be done right. You know, I mean, it's something that I do think people want. I know I've had constituents on to me wanting to know when can they get it.
Do they think you could fix a place in the queue for them?
No, not that. Although given the quality or lack thereof, the management of our health service, yes, a queue, I suppose, is something that people will expect. We're hoping that that won't happen, that indeed it will be orderly. But the other thing I think is really important is there has to be an element of flexibility. So that's why I think it is important that the Dáil and the office will have oversight.
That's exactly what the plan is.
Yeah, and there has to be, because there will be groups that will arise that with the greatest will in the world, people won't have thought of. So, you know, you have kids who are currently at home from school because they have a vulnerable adult or a vulnerable person in their home. Those kids, I think, and their families deserve to get it, though they may not fall directly into one of the categories. And I think there should be enough flexibility there. I do like the idea of having a kind of a rolling questions and answer session or a rolling agenda item that we would be able to come to it. So that way it's not the case that we're constantly putting in questions and looking that we know if there is an issue. I think it would be, rather than a normal kind of a dull debate, more of a kind of a stand-in meeting where it's just, this is an issue, a clearinghouse for issues where you can bring issues and get them resolved. Because I don't think there's anybody in government or in opposition that wants to stand in the way of this. Now, that said, we do have to get the IT right. And the health service in the state does not have a good record when it comes to IT projects. The unique patient identifier has still yet to be established. I don't think that the current system that's used in conjunction with schools to roll out the HPV vaccine is going to be robust enough to deal with what needs to happen. But when the tender goes out, it needs to be actioned very quickly. And the expertise that they will need, if they have to get that in, that has to come in and has to come in quickly.
OK, Hazel, can I bring you into this? Are we being ambitious enough? Because you see across in the UK, they're talking about having tens of millions of people vaccinated within the same kind of, even faster than our time frame, like by April. Like we have only, there's less than 5 million of us. Should we not be more ambitious about, when we could have max vaccinations underway?
I don't think our UK colleagues are necessarily the best example to follow. We have been ahead of them when it comes to a lot of what we rolled out in the last 10 months. We have been ahead of them when it comes to protecting the public and restrictions. And in terms of this plan and the work streams, there are 7 work streams going into place of the overall task force to roll out this programme. And I think ambition is one thing, but keeping people safe and also ensuring from a project management point of view that the rollout is safe and successful and that you tackle the hiccups is what's important. Louise and Regina just said it themselves, that a rolling schedule means that you can spot the issues on a weekly basis, that if there's any IT issues, you spot them and you fix them. But if you become overambitious, what will happen is that people would just look at targets rather than what's practical and what needs to be applied. And what needs to be applied here is a proper a project management structure, which they have in place at the moment.
OK, Hugh, can I bring you in?
Yes.
What's the sense around Leinster House in this? Is there a sense that we're all on the same page, that there's cross-party support for what's being proposed here and how it's being managed?
I think so at the moment. But I mean, it's like everything with this virus. I mean, at the beginning, there was cross-party support and backing for the government. But the longer the pandemic went on, the more you saw that fray, I guess, and you saw the opposition calling out all sorts of errors they believe the government had made, particularly in relation to things like testing and tracing and whether or not a sufficient amount of work was done over the summer to put in place systems for testing and tracing and robust systems, particularly around contact tracing and hiring enough staff. You know, Louise mentioned Ireland on Call there, for example, and the sort of the thousands of expressions of interest, but very low numbers in terms of the amount of staff that were taken on by the health service. So, I think at the moment people are very much behind the vaccine because we're all just desperate to get it. I think the vast majority of the population are desperate to get it because they want the country and life as we knew it to return again. But I think that the longer the rollout goes on and depending on how it goes, and I think you see what the government is doing really is expectation management. It's lowering expectations because, if we've seen, in the countries where it has been approved thus far, so the UK, for example, and in the United States in the last few days, there's been massive expectations set there in terms of, back to normal by next summer. Large proportions of the population vaccinated by April. None of these take account of the potential for the whole rollout of the vaccine to be hit by a third wave of the virus, for example. They don't take account of systems failures, IT failures, perhaps logistical failures. Maybe some of the companies are not able to keep up with the demand.
Do you think there was
so there's lots of things that can go wrong, I suppose, and that's why the government is being perhaps very cautious in their approach to this.
Was there some surprise that GPs were out over the weekend saying, why has nobody spoken to us about it, and pharmacists in the same vein?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was pretty I think the government's kind of probably should have got ahead of that and should have made sure that didn't happen. Because I think, you know, as we said there, like there is a broad cross-party support for this. But if GPs feel that, you know, are hearing in the media that they're going to be involved in this, but they haven't heard anything from the people involved in rolling out the vaccine, then of course they're going to be a little bit annoyed about that. And I think you saw that expression, you know, in a vacuum, without information, this is what kind of emerges, is this kind of displeasure amongst various sectoral groups, interest groups and so on. And I think that that was inevitable that that might happen. So, you know, now we have the report, the implementation plan is finally published. I think perhaps, you know, you will hopefully, I guess, from the government's perspective, get, and from the entire country's perspective, get buy-in from all of the important groups here. And GPs, I suppose, will be central to the administering of the vaccine once, you know, the most vulnerable in the population and healthcare workers are inoculated, then we start moving to more widespread rollout. And, you know, don't forget, this is a vaccine that more than likely people will have to get every year, potentially, like the flu vaccine, for example. So, you know, we're setting up a system here that's going to be in place for years, potentially, decades even. And I suppose it's you know, we'll learn a lot of lessons over the next 12 months as to what works best and what doesn't. And there will be errors along the way. There will be adverse events for some patients. You know, they might be a very small cohort. But, you know, we saw in the UK with the Pfizer vaccine, there was, I think there was two people who had an adverse reaction, and that was a big story. And I think, you know, we'll have similar stories next year. And that will, it'll be important, I think, for public health authorities and for politicians, I suppose.
And for the media as well.
And for the media as well, to give that proportionate coverage, I guess, you know, that these are adverse events, but, you know, the studies and all of the clinical trials and all the science tells us that they are, you know, that they are rare. And that, by and large, the vaccine is extremely safe and effective, which the clinical trials thus far indicate, notwithstanding
they
the fact
indeed.
It's
been
done in record time.
Very briefly on that, I think into the space where that kind of misinformation will go, any hint that the, and this is not particular to the government, so this is the health, the HSE, and as well as the government and the minister, any hint that there's an attempt to try and deflect or hide any of this stuff, I think will be blown up out of all proportion. So I do think, yes, we have to recognise that, you know, there will be adverse events, but they need to be met head on, I think, with, you know, with science, with compassion, with understanding. And, you know, there is a lot when you see online, there is a lot of misinformation. There are people who are already nervous about this when they may not have any reason to be. But it's not good enough for us as leaders in our own community to simply point at someone and say, well, you are wrong and you're awful silly if you believe that. What we need to do is go to people where they're at. So we need to look at the cohorts where there is vaccine hesitancy. And we can see that among younger people very, very particularly.
You can see that again in Sinn Féin supporters.
Because we can see it, exactly, because we can see it among younger people. So there is a real need to take each individual group and to go to where they are. And, you know, not to talk down to people, but to meet people with science, with facts and with information, but also to go to where people are and to be available to answer those questions. So it's not simply a case that politicians will stroll up to the 9 o'clock news, roll their sleeve up and say, well, that's it, now I've done my bit. This is going to be a constant information sharing kind of exercise that I think we all need to engage with. And in order to do that, we need to acknowledge that, yes, there may be issues that will arise, but they will be rare and they will be dealt with. And then we can say with confidence, because I want to have the confidence, as I have at the moment, and I think we all do, to be able to say to people, I'm getting it and I want you to get it as well. And in order to be able to do that, there needs to be absolute transparency around it.
Just given that we saw those polls which suggested there was a significant number of Sinn Féin supporters who had issues and questions around this, are you doing something in the party to address this specifically? Have you plans to deal with this?
The vaccine hesitancy is among younger voters, and that's obviously where there's been a huge growth in the Sinn Féin vote. So that was, you know, that's where the link is there. But the same as all political parties, I think what we have been doing is promoting the vaccine ourselves. Also saying to people, I'm going to get it. So I mean, I've said publicly when it is available, as and when it is my time to get it, you know. And the other thing that will annoy people, of course, is if there's a hint that politicians will skip the queue, which we won't. It'll be based on age.
It's a fine line, isn't it?
Well, it'll be based on age, because some will get it ahead of others. But when the time comes for my age and my category, I will get the vaccine. I don't know of anyone in my family who won't. And that, you know, that's the kind of leadership that I think it is important. But I do think that there needs to be a very organised information campaign that you know, treats people as adults.
Well, I think, and, to be fair, you know, Dr. Ronan Glenn has started on that.
But it's not just it shouldn't just be from the CMO or from HSE, though. To your point there, it should be from every party, because I think if we're going to apply the transparency rule, we also have to apply the unity rule, that this is a case that it's backed by all the parties, and it's the parties that are rolling out this information to all their voters as well as supporters. Like, be it young, be it old, be it anyone, the information comes from a central base where it's the HSE, but it's also coming from the party base as well to inform voters, listen, this is safe, this is what we need to do.
Yeah, I just see an email that came in to us here. Katie, the country's not ready for rolled out vaccinations. I'm not a conspiracy theorist nor a cynic, but I don't trust this government or the HSE to get this right. So there will be, you know, people who are, as I say, not conspiracy
reluctant
theorists,
yeah,
and but will are nervous and concerned.
And I think that's to be expected. But what the job of work that we have to do, not just as leaders, as government, as health service providers and deliverers, is to ensure that there is unity in the message. And that to ensure that if you come to me with a concern, that we address the concern and we talk about it. And so that I can reassure you that it is safe, that vaccines do work, that modern medicine has, you know, revolutionised life in society over the last 100 years, and to prove that it's safe. Now, there will be issues over the next couple of months. There will be a new vaccine that will do something different than the vaccine that we're getting. All of that thing will evolve, and, you know, it will be a rolling debate. And as Louise said, there does need to be transparency. If there is a mistake, if there is a delay, it isn't about covering it up or hiding it. It's about actually putting it out on the table and saying, yeah, we're a week behind. Or, you know, I hope to God we're not, right? But if there are issues, that they get dealt with. Because one chink in what is a very fragile acceptance of those reluctant people will put them off, and then it will actually give credence to the conspiracy theorists. And actually, I fear they're growing. You know, they're not something that's being diminished by people. They're actually growing, and that's really
concerning. Well, there is definitely an active campaign underway. Yeah. I think anyone who looks online can see that. Okay, we'll leave that there, though. As we say, we hope Godspeed and
fingers and toes crossed.
Everything will be in place, and we'll get going with this in January. Okay, we'll move on, because Sinn Féin's Brian Stanley made a statement to The Dáil this evening in which he apologised for two recent controversial tweets. Let's have a listen. Here he deals with his tweet drawing a parallel between the Kilmichael ambush in the War of Independence and the Provisional IRA's Narrow Water attack in 1979.
We need to be able to talk about the past in a way that doesn't cause division or deepen division. We must be sensitive in how we talk about the past and respectful of the views that others and the views that others may hold about the past that may be different. I accept that my tweet regarding the ambushes at Kilmichael and Narrowwater was insensitive, and that it caused hurt and anger. Words can do that, and my words did. And for that, I am truly sorry.
And he also addressed a tweet about Fine Gael leader Leo Varadkar, which was interpreted by some as having homophobic undertones.
The point that I was trying to make was, that's great, but let's also focus on advancing workers' rights and the people rights of people on low income, and economic justice, and issues such as a living wage, which we don't have yet in this country. I accept that is a point that I did not articulate in a very good way, and that tweet is open to different interpretations. I did try to contact the tarnished today to express my apology personally to him, and I will do so again.
And that was Brian Stanley speaking earlier today. Regina, have you spoken to Leo Varadkar? Do you know if he's returned that call from, or that attempt to call?
I haven't.
From?
When I was speaking to the office earlier on, and it was just after tea time, I don't think they had managed to speak to each other. But I know the Taoiseach did say today that obviously he heard the apology. What he thought was a shame was that there wasn't an opportunity for questions to be answered, because I suppose the apology in itself, I suppose, sounded grand, and it'll probably put an end to it this week because it's a week before Christmas and nobody wants to be harping on about the past or nastiness or to have antagonism a week before Christmas when we're all looking forward to spending a little bit of time with our family. But today, Brian said that we need to be respectful that there are different views of the past. There's no different views of the past. That's why we're in and having this conversation, because Brian and other members of Sinn Féin have tried to draw equivalence of events that happened 100 years ago to events that happened 30 years ago, and there's absolutely no equivalence. And that's why we're having this conversation now.
There are different views on that, as in there are people within the Republican, within Sinn Féin and the Republican movement generally, that do believe they can draw a line between those two events.
But then they need to come out and say that. And like, to be fair to Martin Brown last week, he actually had the honesty to say that we need to stop apologising for stuff that we believe in. But then Sinn Féin needs to say that that's what they believe in. But they don't.
Louise.
So I think it's important to note that, and I have had no contact with the Tánaiste in relation to this, but I do note from newspaper reports that he has accepted Brian's apology. And I think that is important. I think, you know, Brian today, he apologised, he explained his motivations, and he was very sincere in his apology for, you know, any offence that might have been caused. I think we do need...
For how he said it, not for
It's about the tone. Feeling. It's about the content.
Well,
he's sorry for being insensitive. He's sorry for hurting your feelings. He's not sorry for what he said. He's not sorry for drawing equivalence between what happened in Cork and what happened in Northern Ireland. He's not sorry about that.
And I think if we are going to have truth and reconciliation, I think it's important that people are respectful to each other. I think that it's important people are respectful of the views of others. I think it is important that we can speak about our history in a way that is collegiate, and indeed that we can move on, and that we can move on together. And that's what Brian was doing today. You know, he was very sincere. He was heartfelt in his apology.
Can I ask
he
you
He wants
just,
now what, to get back to the
okay,
business
Louise,
of representing the people of Leigh Joffley, which is his job.
Can I ask you what Regina, the point Regina is making there? Can we just clarify that? Can any Sinn Féin representative disavow an IRA operation such as Narrowwater publicly? Would that go against what...
It's not a question of disavowing and going against. It is a question of being able to speak about our history in a way that is respectful to others. And Brian acknowledges that the way that he phrased his tweet was disrespectful, and he apologised for that. So I suppose if we want to have these conversations, and we will have them, we are entering into a decade of centenaries now, or we're in the middle of a decade of centenaries, it is important that we can speak respectfully to each other. It's important that we can speak respectfully about our history, and that we can acknowledge that the experiences that people have had that formed their views of their of our own history may not all have been the same. And that we can speak to each other in a collegiate and in a respectful way. And I think that's our focus. That's what we want to do. And I think that is extremely important.
The first thing you can't do is rewrite history. You just can't. I'm sorry. Like, there is absolutely no equivalence to the War of Independence and what happened at the hands of the Provisional IRA and all of the forces that reacted from the 1970s onwards. There's no equivalence. And anybody that attempts to draw equivalence is bonkers. There's none. And I'm sorry, you can't have a respectful debate about a lie.
And
so that's what we're asking here. And we'll never agree. And so, sorry for interrupting for a second.
I think,
never agree about that history, and that's fine, right? So I have a view and you have a different view. But what actually is really intolerable is the insult that you got today was that I'm sorry for hurting your feelings. I'm sorry for the tone of my tweet, but I'm not sorry for what I said. Because he's not sorry for what he said. He did draw equivalence. Martin Brown did exactly the same when he referred to the people that who bombed Warren Point with heroes of the War of Independence. It's not the same. In nobody's world is it the same. And it is not acceptable for people who are democratically elected to draw equivalents of terrorist organisations of the 70s, 80s and 90s, of an army council that directed those in back rooms in Belfast with the heroes that won independence for our country. It's just not acceptable. I'm sorry. And it's not just Brian.
Okay,
Mary Lou did the same. She wasn't, she wasn't talking about content, she was talking about tone. It's not about the tone.
Okay, Hugh, you're getting in there.
Well, I mean, it is the position. I mean, Louise is free to correct me if I'm wrong, but it is the position of Sinn Féin that, in effect, what the Provisional IRA were doing was carrying on the work of the IRA in the 1920s in trying to get Britain out of Ireland, effectively, off the island of Ireland. And the means by which they did it, they resorted to violence. There was appalling atrocities carried out. But it is the narrative of Sinn Féin, and again, I'm open to correction, that it there is a kind of a straight line from the IRA of the 1920s to the Provisional IRA in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And
there's no line.
That is their line. That is their position. That is the position they stuck to.
Is that an accurate representation of Martin Brown on the radio?
I don't think
we should be ascribing a position to her.
Well, I said I was open to correction.
I don't think that the history of our nation and the history of the conflict is going to be resolved either by one tweet or indeed by one radio programme or indeed by one soundbite. And as Regina has said quite rightly, it might be that we may never agree, but I would hope that we can agree that when we discuss our past, that we do so in a respectful way, that we do so in a way that is mindful of the experiences, and that we follow the example of people like Martin McGuinness, people who were peacemakers. And you know, I mean, Brian,
but
was very,
I noticed, Louise, you are carefully avoiding responding to the question, which is what Hugh described there, does that characterise your view of that historical line?
Can my view of Irish history be characterised by one journalist in one sentence? Probably not. Should we be allowed the time and space in order to have conversations? Yes, I think we should. Is it going to be difficult? Yeah, it probably is. But we need to do it, and we need to do it in a respectful way.
So I've given you lots of time and space now.
And when we talk about having those conversations with people with whom we disagree, it's not about rehearsing what happened. It is about being able to make our peace and reconciliation and move forward. So there will always be differing views. And I mean, that is a fact. When we look back, there will always be differing views. But if we can agree that when we speak respectfully, and when we come together to discuss our shared history, that we are respectful of the experiences of all people. And that involves being respectful of the experiences of nationalists who lived in the north, who were brutalised and victimised, and also the experiences of people who worked really hard to bring about peace in this island. And that is what we want. We have peace, we have reconciliation, and we want to build on that. I spend my days working hard for the people of North County Dublin who have elected me and who have put their trust in me. I don't spend my days looking backwards, but on the specific view,
because this has now been, as you say, it's unavoidable. It's a discussion that has to be had. It will be had again and again over the coming years because of the years we're entering into and you know, our commemorations and centenaries. The drawing that line from the 1920s to the IRA, the Provisional IRA campaign of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. It's not a surprise to me that this is what decades of
struggle for liberation are there. And I mean, we all know it. And, you know, to say that this is legitimate, this is not legitimate, that, you know, somehow the election in 1918 gave legitimacy to one group. But then when you ask, well, what about 1916, pre the election? You know, are we going to have that discussion? I don't hear anybody on the government side or in Fine Gael disavowing the men and women of 1916. So yes, if we're going to have the conversation, let's have it. But I mean, it's not going to happen here this evening, and the resolution certainly won't be brokered here this evening. And as has already been said, there will be issues around which we just will not agree.
Hazel, can I bring you in? Just one other another element which caused some controversy when it emerged in the last couple of weeks in relation to Brian Stanley. And this is this radio interview where this is going back to last March, the early days of the coronavirus. And he expressed the view that he wouldn't be happy to eat chicken from a Chinese because he was worried it might carry the coronavirus. Some people said that had racist undertones. Was that unfair?
I'm kind of laughing here because I'm starting to think Deputy Stanley should not use Twitter and stay away from.
I think Mary Lou McDonald has already advised that.
And that's not to be disrespectful, but I think it's just we get put on the spot on a lot of things, especially when you're on radio and when you're on Twitter and social, and sometimes it's not taught true. I would hope that Deputy Stanley did apologise for that remark and that it wasn't to incite anything. I haven't heard it myself, so having not heard it, I rather not pass judgment on it, but I hope that he wasn't inciting anything. So,
and generally, having heard the apologies for the two controversial tweets, do you think that's it now, and that he deserves to be left alone and go back to his job as PAC chair?
The question is, does his tweets and what he does affect his ability to be chair? And I don't think it necessarily does. So I think this conversation we've had here tonight is discussing history and from celebrating and commemorating a Bloody Sunday recently, what I noticed one line in one of the history books was, our streets are lined with blood. There is divisions from all sides. There has been death from all sides. And what we need to do right now, moving forward into the commemoration period, is to remember those that we lost and to unite where we can, and where we can't, that we hold on to that grief and loss and mourning, and respect those that have lost people. And we move on to a better society. That's all I can say in terms of Deputy Stanley. I hope he does a good job in the Dáil, and I hope he stays away from Twitter for a little while. So, and that's not to mock him over anything. It is very much just cool off for a bit.
So. Okay. And what about Hugh? If I can ask you, I think the general consensus is that Brian Stanley did enough today and was seen to have, been sincere, particularly with his apology in relation to that tweet about Leo Varadkar, that he can move on from this. What about Martin Brown? Where does that stand with people in Leinster House?
It's not quite clear, Katie. Sinn Féin have said that he's ill, and that's one of the, and the Fine Gael had sought a meeting of the Oireachtas Petitions Committee, which Martin Brown is the chair of, this week, in order for him to address the controversy over his interview with Tip FM last week. And Sinn Féin have said that Martin Brown is ill, but Martin's not making an issue of that, and that Fine Gael didn't have the numbers to win a vote to bring Martin Brown in to address this controversy over his interview. Sinn Féin disputes that and says that Fine Gael didn't have the numbers. So it's a really kind of niche political row at an Oireachtas committee level. I don't detect a great enthusiasm from Fine Gael to push this to, in the week before Christmas, to such an extent that, they'll be hauling Martin Brown in next week or whatever, or whenever he's feeling better again. I don't think this is something that's going to drag into January. And I think one of the things that Sinn Féin did very effectively in kind of neutering this political controversy was giving Brian Stanley the week off last week, or giving him time to be with his family and away from the Leinster House bubble, because that did, to a certain extent, take the sting out of the controversy. And allowed Brian to come in today and be very contrite in his apology and sincere, I think, as Louise said, and I think that's kind of appreciated across the Dáil chamber. I think even I know of one Fine Gael TD who went up and said, kind of said well done, and that probably wasn't easy for you, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say he'd be well liked generally across
absolutely,
parties.
Yeah.
No, he would, and I think he's recognised as a good chair on the PAC, because the PAC is one of the, I'm not on the PAC, and there's days when I absolutely, I'm so grateful that I'm not on it. But it is one of those committees where it can be quite fractious. There's a lot of jockeying for position and a lot of vying for time. And I think Brian is seen as being very fair by all of the members on the committee, because sometimes as a committee chair, your fairness is decided by how you allocate the time. And that is important, particularly at the moment, because our committees are all limited to a maximum of 2 hours per session. So when you have something like the PAC, which could normally go on for 5 and 6 hours at a time.
Allocation of time becomes
it
very...
It really does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can Can I, Regina, are you happy to let the Martin Brown thing slide?
Come here. The committee is going to sit at some point, you know, and the man is sick this week, leave him alone. But he's going to have to answer the questions. But as I said to you earlier on in my contribution, at least he had the honesty to admit his views on radio last week. Now, I know they're being challenged this week, but it's not something that you get very often from Sinn Féin representatives. You've heard Louise talk around all of the houses without answering the question that you asked her about the past. You can't rewrite history. And we don't have a shared history if your view is different to mine. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The history is obvious to the Irish people that there was no correlation between the events 100 years ago. Sinn Féin didn't have its 100th birthday party last week, as they claimed and tried to claim on social media. It's a lie. You know, it's not going to go away.
Martin did, in his, when he was kind of, I suppose, confronted, for want of a better word, by Fine Gael TDs about his remarks at the committee meeting last week, he was quite clear, I suppose, in that he didn't feel he had anything to apologise for. He said that, he seemed to imply that the newspaper, the print interpretations or characterizations of his interview were sort of inaccurate, and if anybody went back and listened to the interview on Tip FM, that he would that, you know, they'd be very clear as to where he stood, and that it wouldn't be as at all controversial as portrayed. That's not the case at all, having listened to his interview and reported on it in the Independent. I mean, he did say that he had called to members' homes in the past when he was unhappy with you know, some of their social media content, or when there was disagreements with them about other issues. He did make a very long and passionate and impassioned contribution in relation to the British occupation of Ireland, and, you know, that they were here for, you know, they're here for 800 years, and that, you know, he was very clear in drawing that line between what happened in the 1920s and what happened in the north, and I suppose the struggle continues in terms of Sinn Féin and getting you know, a united Ireland. So I don't think he feels that he has anything to apologise for necessarily. So I think it'll be, if Fine Gael are going to pursue that in the new year, it's going to be interesting to see how it all breaks down. But I dare say the voters don't really care about these rows anymore. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that Sinn Féin performed very strongly in the last general election. And I think an awful lot of people that voted for Sinn Féin really don't get swayed by these kind of controversies and by Fine Gael repeatedly banging on about them.
Indeed. OK, well, we'll stop banging on about it as well, because we want to move on. Because the Irish Examiner is reporting tonight that a number of Green Party councillors have made it clear to TDs that if they ratify the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement between Canada and the European Union, that they will leave the party. Hazel Chew, what is going on in the Green Party with CETA?
Well, the Greens are having discussions. We always had said in our previous two programme for government negotiations, and even in 2016 when we passed internally a motion at our special at our annual convention, that we were opposing investor courts, and the motion passed, and that was our existing policy. So as it stands, there's an internal discussion to be had around CETA, and I know Eamon said it this morning that he will be speaking to members. I myself have been speaking to the management committee and also the leadership in relation to the matter, and various people have contacted me, and I think what you see in the next couple of weeks is a membership discussion on the matter, which is actually really good, because we are a grassroots party. We've always said we are a grassroots party, and these policies are member-led.
Yeah, but how did it happened the way it did? Because as we understood, as you say, you had a convention on this. A policy was decided on 4 years ago now, isn't it? That you would work as a party to prevent the ratification of CETA at national and European level.
Mm-hmm.
So that was your policy. It did not appear in the programme for government, and Nessa Harrigan has tweeted that she worked hard. That wasn't just an oversight, that there was work put into keeping it out of the programme for government. And then party leader and three other ministers let it go through cabinet last month. How that surely is very poor management of what was inevitably going to be a very sensitive issue for your members.
I think what we need to look at is how these processes are reviewed internally, and that's something that we need to do ourselves and for our membership as well, because there has been members asking and we have been providing answers. But what comes next is the most important, because if the vote is pushed to January for ratification, then what we need to decide of on a membership level is whether we accept this policy or not. But let's look at the wider issue with CETA, and why do we need to ratify it now? Because for me, I would like to see it through a Oireachtas Oversight Committee. I don't think there is necessary a need to ratify it right now when many countries haven't done it. Like, I would like to see the domestic debates happen in Germany, in Italy, in France. So like, Cyprus has already voted it down, so there is no hurry. So I would like to see that pushed out onto a later date, and internally we will solve our members' issues.
When did you find out that this had been gone through cabinet and that a vote was due? Today it was due to happen.
I raised it on the Saturday at executive, and I know...
This is Saturday just gone?
Yeah, it's Saturday just gone, and I know Patrick Oslo and Nessa Hergen would have raised it on the Friday. So now, it was itemed in a memo before that, but it's something that didn't have full discussion until this weekend among the party. So a lot of members saw it this weekend and started discussing it. And discussion is a good thing. So
yeah, I saw Nessa Horrigan say that she had raised it, she'd asked about it, and that nobody got back to her.
Well, it was a weekend. So I know that's a flippant answer, but when you are working nonstop over a period to mitigate stuff and to run a coalition or to be in government, then weekends are important. But at the same time, I think there should have been a system in place where Nessa was replied to and information provided to her. But from what I heard recently was that there was a cabinet meeting on the Saturday, I think, or Sunday. So obviously people were working in the background.
Well, I mean, my understanding of this is that the cabinet signed off on this towards the end of November, I think the 22nd or 24th of November, thereabouts. So the reality is this would have come across the desk of Catherine Martin, Eamon Ryan, Roderick O'Gorman and Pippa Hackett, who also sits at cabinet. So you know, I suppose it's the question really is, why didn't they inform their Green colleagues that suddenly they'd approved of this, which seems to be a massive diversion from what Green Party policy was.
But it's not a massive diversion from what's in the programme for government.
That's true, yeah.
Which says support new and existing EU trade deals. So I think, you know, I mean, Hazel makes reference to when you're working flat out. When you're working flat out, you probably work the weekends as well. Now, I mean, there's an internal thing, obviously, with regard to people ignoring the TD's request for information and stuff. But you can't get away from the fact that this was agreed by the four Green reps that sit at cabinet, and it was agreed weeks ago. They were trying to ram it through with 55 minutes of debate, as agreed to by the Green Party reps at cabinet. So I suppose it's a nice story that there's going to be all of this discussion. But the truth is that you have signed up to supporting EU trade deals as part of the programme for government. And in any event, the foremost senior elected representatives from your party that sit at cabinet had agreed to this and agreed to 55 minutes, which, you know, we are talking about a massive trade deal, something which requires a huge amount of scrutiny and discussion. 55 minutes is an absolute affront to people. The fact that it was accepted and then afterwards people cry foul and say it may or it may not be against policy. I mean, I presume that the people who sit at the head of your party, your leader and your deputy leader, have some passing knowledge of your party policy. And yet they gave this the nod. And, you know, the thinking was it was going to go through. It would go through this week, which is the last week before Christmas, when a whole load of stuff. And anyone that sits in the Dáil knows this. This week is always busy. And it's a handy week if you want to sneak something through. And I think the fact that people have cottoned on to it, and we see there was public outrage about it. So that's what got it off the agenda. It certainly wasn't a request from any one person. It was the fact that there was public outrage.
Let me just watching the time. And I just want to get, because we hear that there was a very robust conversation between the three party leaders in the coalition, with Fine Gael in particular wondering, you know, really annoyed with Eamon Ryan that he hadn't got his ducks in a row on this and they couldn't deliver his 12 TDs.
And so to be fair, and not to be disrespectful, and I know NESA has said it a number of times, it is in the programme for government. There's a whole section on trade. Louise has just said it, that the programme for government specifically states that we'll support new and existing EU trade deals to expand Ireland's exports. And at a time where our exports to Britain are potentially going to be shrinking, this is hugely important. And so it wasn't a case of that it had been sneaked through this week, and Christmas week is always mad. We've had hours of debate in the Shannon and the Dáil over the last number of years on this.
The Shannon vote.
And so it's really welcome.
So the only place where there was
it's
a vote,
really
so I just put across,
the
only place where there was a vote.
Are going to have an internal conversation over the next couple of
weeks.
Okay,
can we have one voice? Sorry, the Shannon voted to reject.
To reject it back in 2016, which is the only place where there has been a comprehensive debate. And the end result of that debate was actually to reject this agreement. So yes, debate is important, but the government need to understand.
It's hugely important. What I'm clarifying is that you're trying to say that we haven't had any debate on this and we've had hours.
It's welcome
that the Green Party are going to have a conversation over the next couple of weeks, because whatever concerns are still there by some of the party members either need to be addressed and they do need to be listened to. Well, I don't know what the obvious outcome is, but if the leader and the deputy leader of the party, who did have the same concerns that are being expressed by colleagues now, have had those concerns allayed, well, then maybe the information that they have that you got, and I'm not trying to be smart, but maybe you don't have it yet, might all be resolved when you sit around the
table. Can I just ask two things, Hazel? Hazel, can I ask you, is it in the programme for government in your view? That
in my view, not as chair of the party, but in my view as a councillor, I don't think it is. So as the chair of a party, I can't give you an answer because I want to stay neutral on that. But as a councillor, as a Green councillor, I do not think it's in the programme for government.
It's on the trade section.
No, Regina, I read the trade section. The trade section said new and existing treaties. If it was to be there, it would have said CETA, because it would have been very clear front and centre that people would want to ratify this trade deal. Now, saying
but
that...
But it is an existing treaty.
That's a nice story, but it doesn't
In the real world,
people read the programme for government. People, they know what they're supporting. This is a bad deal. It should absolutely be opposed.
Louise, I think you should know by now that there were people who were against the programme for government as well within the party. If they too, and they were TDs as well, if they too thought that CETA was in the deal, they would have raised it as something that they shouldn't be passing. But no one raised it at the time because, again, CETA is not there. Now, saying that, the resolution that we are looking at, to Regina's point, that it's good that we're looking at the internal discussion, but overall, as an external point, we need to have a Oireachtas Oversight Committee to debate this, to look at the merits of whether we should have investor court, which
would be an issue. I have one
more minute,
and I want to put one last thing to you. It's a tweet by your former MEP candidate, Saoirse McHugh. She tweeted today, Eamon Ryan's capacity to sell out is the only truly renewable resource. I mean, there is a lot of ill feeling within the Green Party about this, on top of, you know, there was so many issues in the last number of months. The climate bill wasn't good enough for many of your younger members in particular. There was those issues about the unsealed the records and how that was handled by Roderick O'Gorman. You know, and now we're hearing again that there's threats of more councillors are talking about resigning if this goes through.
The question. So I'm waiting for the question, Katie.
No, well, the question is, I just want you to respond to that tweet from Saoirse McHugh.
I guess I would say I understand where Saoirse's frustration is coming from as a member that has left the party and has not seen eye to eye on self. But I would ask that people don't get personal when it comes to Twitter. We've just had a whole discussion on Twitter and how tone and is important. So I would ask people not get personal in relation to her concerns, if the substantial part of her concerns in relation to CETA, that is something we have to look at. And it's something that we have to look at as a government, not just within our party itself.
Our government has already ratified CETA. It did it nearly 3 weeks ago.
Well, the question is why, though?
Because we think it's a good deal, because our exports to Canada have increased by 35% at a time when our export companies need those
exports.
And
can you tell me about the investor court issue? Why push investor courts when you have existing courts? Why favour investor above all.
The European Court of Justice have already told us, based on the appeal that has been made, that we are subservient. The EU law will always trump everything else.
Okay, you know,
I don't think the court system is a good system.
I think we're going to have to have...
Not good for people, not good for Labour.
We're going to have to do this another night, and I'm sure we will be, because this is something that's going to have to some resolution to this is going to have to be found. But we're going to have to move on, because I want to get to this. I've been looking forward to it all evening. I want to ask, does anyone remember the name Needop? It's a Dutch company, tech company. Any takers? Well, prepare to be enlightened, because they or their machines are the topic of tonight's late diversion. The machines we are talking about were the infamous e-voting machines. David Davenport, formerly of this parish, you're very welcome to Late Debate.
Yeah, thanks a lot now.
Let's start right at the beginning. Who first introduced the prospect of e-voting and why?
Well, the whole saga began in 1999, when the then Environment Minister Noel Dempsey, with, it must be said, the enthusiastic backing of Bertie Ahern, came up with the notion of replacing our tried and trusted paper-based electoral system with an electronic voting. The 2000 Electoral Amendment Act changed the law. That followed, and Dempsey announced that the new system would be trialled in three constituencies in the next general election, which took place in 2002.
And as I recall, at the time, Noel Dempsey was pretty evangelical about this new
He thought they were the bee's knees, and he was evangelical, messianic in pursuit of the plan. I personally recall being lunched by the minister at the time, where he spelled out what he said was the need for electronic voting to bring us into the 20th century. Noel Dempsey thought that the foreign multinationals here were appalled by our Dickensian system of voting, and that the image it presented could even deter future investment. He was completely unmoved by arguments around the spectacle and the drama of counts. He clearly felt that newspapers and RTE in particular had a vested interest in the status quo, as election counts undoubtedly sold newspapers and TV advertising. And I came away from the whole encounter thinking that while politically minded people and people involved like myself might think that counts were incredibly exciting, that the people at the centre of them, like Noel Dempsey, just wanted them to be over as quickly as possible, and electronic voting suited them down to the ground.
No, we like the drama. We like it. And I tell you what we should do. And I don't know, will other people agree with me on this one, but I believe what we should move to is a system whereby we hand sort and machine count. So you still get to do your tallies, you get your results in quick time, and it's also that you get your results very quick, but it's also very accurate, and you can still do your tally. I'd hate to see the tally go, that's being honest. Now, I say this as someone who's only stood in elections twice and has been elected on both occasions. I might have a different view.
I was going to say if you're at the other end of that.
No, and I'm sure I might, but I think we should machine hand sort and machine count. You keep your tally, you get your results.
I think I'm probably the only person at the table who actually got to vote in that election, because Meath was one of the three constituencies.
It was.
So was
Fingal. I was just going to ask exactly to talk us through. There was Dublin West, Dublin North and Meath, wasn't it?
We were a five-seater at the time. I think it was my first time. Probably my first time voting in that constituency. So it was exciting, and then it was devastating in the same...
We're all still trying to store them somewhere.
I remember...
I was talking to the research today, because they were stored in Kilbride, and I'm sure farmers made a fortune off the back of them being stored for donkey's years before they were decommissioned.
I hope that wasn't the entire purpose. That's an old Dempsey.
Okay, we'll move on, because I want to play... I remember I was actually in an RTE studio that night. We were covering, doing an election analysis. I don't know where you were, David, but we were waiting for that moment. They were filling us with coffee, because it went on until the wee hours of the morning. And let's have a listen to the moment where they announced the result of that first ever electronic vote.
And those elected were as follows: Trevor Sargent, Sean Ryan, Jim Glennon, and G.B. You got that, did you? Ladies and gentlemen, as return officer for the constituency of Dublin North, I said the other one was cheering, G.V. Wright.
And Trevor Sargent as well. That's the second time she's lost her seat since first elected in 1981.
I remember that picture on the front page of the paper.
Katie, chaos, drama and heartbreak in Dublin North. I mean, it was the most brutal introduction for Nora Owen
to
electronic voting. I mean, as you recall, she learned she lost the seat she'd held for on and off for 9 years, only when the returning officer made the official announcement from the stage. There was no heads up, and everybody saw her being comforted in a very public way by Labour's Sean Ryan as the news sank in. And that's where I think, anyway, the politicians began to have serious misgivings with what the government was planning.
Yeah, Noel Dempsey stayed on course and was still enthusiastic, even though, as you say, there was at that stage a sense that, oh, maybe we're going down the wrong road here. Take me on. Then it wasn't put to one side at that stage.
No, Noel Dempsey was pretty sanguine about it. He pressed ahead. Himself, he was replaced by Martin Cullen, who was equally enthusiastic. There were further trials in the second Nice referendum. A second internal government report cast doubts in the system. But the die was cast from the taxpayers' point of view when Martin Cullen bought 7,500 voting machines at a cost of €53 million. I mean, it's amazing, really, when you think about it. It was a spirited campaign against the machines led by technology experts like Joe McCarthy and Margaret McGailey. And I personally remember that at one stage, Martin Cullen paraded some middle-ranking civil servants to counter his arguments, and they were distinctly uncomfortable at being thrust into the limelight at a news conference, and they failed dismally to convince. But look, by then, Enda Kenny and the opposition had turned against the scheme, and disaster struck when an officially appointed commission it reported in 2004, quite simply, that while the machines might be just about okay, the security of the software couldn't be guaranteed.
And that was really the death knell. I've been told I only have a minute, or you only have a minute, David. That was the death knell, really, once there was question marks over the software and the accuracy. That was it.
There was. I mean, I suppose the bottom line is that they were stored at a cost of some $800,000 a year. But the punchline, really, to the story is that they were sold off after 12 years, after costing €55 million to a metal recycling firm that's paid effectively €10 each for 75,000 machines. So the whole saga cost us about €55 million. If I have time, just one final observation. The 2002 general election, which they were trialled, saw a meltdown for Fine Gael. The party lost 23 seats. Now, there's only three constituencies voted by EV, but if the result had been produced across the country by electronic voting machines, we would have had a Trump moment, and Fine Gael supporters would understandably have been claiming electoral fraud. You can imagine the furore. So I think those silly old Pian Luis are going to be with us for a little while yet.
Indeed. Now, it's not going to be the end of it, though, I think, because we're going to return to this topic in the new year when we'll be looking at the public's appetite for electronic voting, except this time you wouldn't even have to leave your own kitchen to cast your vote. David Davenport, many, many thanks for that great trip down memory lane. We'll take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And that's our lot for tonight. The programme was produced by Caroline Dalton, research was by Andrew Fleming, Elaine Conlon is the broadcast coordinator, and Mark McGrath was on sound. And now, with apologies again, Col, real apologies, over to Col Murray on Late.